World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Bressel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 515, and it's October 18th, 1981. Happiness this evening was getting news over the media, the major media, that Andreas Papandreou won the election in Greece. I was hoping he would. It was a major comeback for him. At the time the Greek military junta took place in Greece, he was awakened at night with a knife at his throat, and he was put in a prison, and he went into exile in Canada and was able to come back to Greece when the junta was overthrown, and he won the election to be president of Greece today. In 1972, with my first published article in The Realist, some of you have that article, some of you don't have it, I wrote the story, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, or How Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And in that article, besides the abuse of Martha Mitchell, I went into the historical perspective of Watergate in 1972. This was my first published article after 9 years of research, and it not only covered the people in Watergate, but American assassins and how Richard Nixon really came to power. And in that article, for those of you who don't have it, I mentioned how the FBI had abused Martha Mitchell and how John Mitchell sided with President Nixon and went along with his policies and ignored his wife. And in that article, I said the discrediting of Martha Mitchell by Jack Anderson was because he was familiar with Frank Sturgis of the Bay of Pigs and the Kennedy assassination, and his role was to make her look silly and crazy at the time. I also wrote then that the manner in which Martha was handled simply indicates how the fascist police agents are forced to treat any witness to their espionage acts. Part of the invisible government was visible to Martha Mitchell, and she panicked. She had to be a political prisoner because she was witness to dirty work. This year, 1972, I wrote, is the most important year in American history, and there's a parallel now with Ronald Reagan in office. We had a relaxation in the time period, but I also wrote in that article Reagan would be the selected next president after Agnew, who came out with the Watergate wash. But I said in 1972 that was the most important year in American history because of provisions made to eliminate our Constitution, take away our democratic rights, and assemble a fascist dictatorship. A new cabinet had been designed by Roy Ash of Litton Industries that would trim away every department except defense, treasury, state, and justice. And of course, Ronald Reagan now is doing away with the energy and education. I wrote the same groups of people who put Adolf Hitler into power and revived fascism in Greece and other countries are determined to maintain power and control over other people's lives. This decisive year will determine if that power will be maintained by manipulating candidates, assassinating politicians, and creating situations where martial law will be necessary and possibly to cancel elections. Whenever a populist candidate appears to win an election which could bring economic or social improvements for the masses, that person will be removed. The CIA that killed President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy did a test case in Greece on canceling their elections. Andreas Papandreou, often compared with John Kennedy, appeared to have a good chance of winning Greek elections in 1967. The United States Army, the CIA, and the government agents helped replace the elections in Greece with a coup d'etat, and that was done under Litton Industries and Roy Ash as the cover for the coup d'etat. I wrote, a fascist dictatorship then returned to Europe. This is in Greece, the first since World War II. The same CIA that helped fund the canceling of elections in Greece offered Richard Nixon the money he needed to become 1968 for the election to become a candidate if he would take political unknown Spiro Agnew as vice president. Now, the response to that article that came out in August of 72 was a letter from Andreas Papandreou in December of 72. And I believe several years ago, it was 1980 or so, I read this on the air, and I'll read it again tonight because this is the first letter from a foreign president that I've ever received, and I'm very proud of it. And I might say that no American senator or member of the House of Representatives or the state elected officials or public officials acknowledge the work or what I was saying in that article on Martha Mitchell, on the CIA, on political assassinations, and it had many items that are pertinent to the world today. In fact, most of that article is pertinent to today. But Andres Papandreou wrote to me December the 10th, 1972. He got a hold of my article published by Paul Krasner in The Realist, and he wrote, "Dear May Brussel, I'm overwhelmed by the amount of work you have done and the documentation you bring to support your thesis. I have tried myself for a long time to bring out the conspiratorial aspects of the Greek coup of 1967, read it, American coup, and just how now, 5 years later, does it seem the people are beginning to understand how it happened that Greece was under a dictatorship. Your work is tremendously important. You have understood the framework in which these events take place, but more than that, you have dug out the facts. I would like to continue to get your material, The Realist and any publication of conspiracy newsletter. I'm enclosing $10 for that purpose. Yours in struggle, Andreas G. Papandreou," and this evening he is now president of Greece. What I would like to do is to raise some money, because I really don't have the funds myself. It's a day-to-day struggle. Would be to raise money through various people contributing to send a complete set of the radio tapes from KLRB for the past 2 years to Greece to Andreas Papandreou. I wanted to do it when he was a candidate, but waited to see if he became the president so that he and his intelligence community can put together information that I have had on the air, on the station, and other stations the past 2 years that will be useful to his survival and to the free world, and let them work with this information and, again, put it in its historical context. But the point is that he did acknowledge the work I had done. He appreciated the effort I had in writing that article and comparing the coup we had in this country and the coup that we're under since the Kennedy assassination and the similarities to what happened in Greece. Now, if he could overthrow the CIA and the military junta in Greece, we should be able to overthrow the CIA and the military junta in the United States. That includes Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter and George Bush and our Nixon, our great ex-president Nixon, who's traveling around, and General Haig, and all those people who were involved either in the murder of John Kennedy or in the cover-up of John Kennedy. All of the top people in government today just about had a finger in either the planning the murder, the exploitation of the murder. That's Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Alexander Haig, and the entire intelligence community. Mr. Casey, Mr. Richard Allen, Walter Stessel, all of them had a part. Walter Stessel was ambassador to Soviet Union for the United States at the time Lee and Marina Oswald came to this country, and Lee worked for Navy intelligence. If Greece can overthrow that coup, we should be able to get rid of them completely. I wish we would someday before there's so much bloodshed in this country. Now, the White House is urging the Restriction on the Freedom of Information Act, and of course they are, because in those pieces of document are the proof that they are the murderers that we have accused them of being, and that's why they don't want you to have that information. It's important to write to your congressman. I don't know whether it's going to take a revolution, maybe not a letter, but raise the level of awareness of what the freedom of information is. There is a hearing on Project MKUltra, the CIA program of research in behavioral modification. In 1977, investigation in the Senate on this particular subject of mind control, and at the time the hearings began, the Select Committee on Intelligence and Subcommittee of Health and Scientific Research, they were hamstrung because for 2 years the Senate Health Committee heard, this is a direct quotation, heard chilling testimony about human experimentation and activities of the CIA, and the deputy director of the CIA said there were 30 universities and institutions and experimentation on unwitting citizens. But former director of the CIA, Richard Helms, just before he left the CIA to become ambassador over at Iran, destroyed in January 1973, on instructions, all the records of the Health Subcommittee. He had those destroyed, or thought he did. And the point of these hearings, which I just got a copy of, I have some of the Senate hearings, but this is another book I didn't have. The point of these hearings is that when Richard Helms testified and when the Congress was investigating mind control, the CIA, the director of the CIA, and no single individual, this is a direct quote, could be found who remembered the details. Not the director of the CIA who ordered the documents destroyed. No responsible person could remember the mind control programs. But it says one individual remembered and through the Freedom of Information request accomplished what two U.S. Senate committees could not do. He spurred the agency into finding additional records pertaining to CIA programs of experimentations with human subjects. And then it showed they were more extensive. There were 86 universities, unethical behavior, and so forth. So I believe the one person was Mr. Marx, who wrote The Cult of Intelligence with Victor Marchetti. But by knowing about the Freedom of Information Act and where to ask, he broke open what all those other bastards were hiding, and information began to gush forward. That's how important the Freedom of Information Act is. Now, why are they hiding the Freedom of Information Act now? Because mostly because almost all the people in office were behind the assassination teams and the connivory. And also, another thing is that when they were investigating the mind control programs in 1977, they had already set up the lease of Jonestown for Jim Jones to begin his experimentations. And if they lock up these papers, you won't be able to get into the information of how Jonestown was set up by the CIA. Now, this last week, there was a lawsuit filed by members of Jonestown, a $63.4 million suit against the government, saying that Jim Jones had been an agent of the CIA since November of 1963. They said from November 63 until November 18th, 1978, James Warren Jones was an employee, servant, agent, operative of the CIA. The suit charges that former Secretary of State Vance, Cyrus Vance, and former CIA Director Stanfield Turner, this is under President Jimmy Carter, took part in a conspiracy to enhance the economic and political power of James Warren Jones in order to get control over people who had a tendency towards a socialist perspective. Cyrus Vance and Turner, who was in the CIA in Annapolis, a classmate of Jimmy Carter, are named in the suit. One of the people there, Monica Bagby, was wounded at the ambush at the airport. And these are people that worked with Jones. Now, if they go back a little further, Jim Jones' CIA work began in Richmond, Indiana, the hometown of Dan Mitrione, who went down to South America for his torturing and control of populations down in South America. But Jim Jones was in Brazil with the CIA in 1961 and 62. And I might say with regard to the Jonestown story, I believe I was the first person in the United States to link Richard Nixon and the Watergate defendants to the CIA. And I was the first person I know of any journalist or radio announcer who made the connections of Jim Jones to the CIA. In fact, I called attention to that to Leo Ryan's Joe Holsinger, plus a lot of other material, which turned out to be true. Now, these aren't the families of the CIA, of the people that were killed there. I talked with Mrs. Bouquet this week. I met her right after her son was killed down there, and I talked with Mr. Harris, whose daughters had been killed down there, and his former wife. At the time I talked to them, they thought I was like from outer space. They couldn't relate to what I was saying. It's a few years later now, and those people whose children were killed also want to get interested. But this is a suit of people who helped Jim Jones, who were the inside team, that say it tantamount that they were working with and are part of the CIA. And also, I'm going to make connections for you to CIA, to that Nguyen Bank in Australia, to Jimmy Carter. And this is one of the reasons, as much as I knew about Ronald Reagan at the time of the elections, and I could list 40 things that were terrifying about Reagan, I could not vote for Jimmy Carter in the last election, because his first remark about Jonestown, let's not overreact about Jonestown, but now it's turning out that Jimmy Carter and his entire cabinet and team were very much part of the Wilson, Edwin Wilson, Frank Turpel, Thomas Klein, CIA experimentation programs, and part of the dirtiest undercover work that I'm going to go into more in detail on this program this evening about their role in the Sadat murder. These are the worst conniving thieves, because they act gentle, like they're interested in human rights. They're your friend, and they have all the accoutrements of the fine Christian gentleman. It's as bad as it is when you get an outright fascist like Haig or Reagan, you know where you stand. They look at your eyeball and eyeball and say, I hate you. You're either black or Jew or move over. They don't make any pretense. I'm rich and you're poor and I'm going to eat off of this china, wear these clothes, and that's my style. So what? They are up front. There's the one, Rosalind Carr says, well, I wouldn't use the china, but they did a lot more and a lot worse. And now this lawsuit is going into this, which was the Jimmy Carter regime, and we can't forget about that. I also want to mention just very briefly tonight the death of Moshe Dayan. It came as such a shock after the murder of Sadat, and I believe tonight when I saw television the funeral of Dayan was the first time I think I ever remember crying at the funeral of somebody on television. I look at these things more in a cerebral sense, but I know people that were very close to Moshe Dayan, some of my very closest friends, and there was a quality about that man that had no more resemblance to Begin than Jesus Christ has to Jimmy Carter. They were totally opposed. They were different kinds of animals. Moshe Dayan was a genuine Jew, a sincere person, a real person. There wasn't this intelligence aura about him, this phoniness, this dangerous thievery about him. He was a genuine man, and I feel very badly about him. And later, in a few weeks, I'll talk about the politics of Begin and the Jewish tragedy. I've been wanting to do it for a long time, but I'm not going to do it this evening. I'll do it later. Also, just a couple of words quickly about the Oswald exhuming. I mentioned it the Sunday night when I came in. That Sunday, they'd exhumed the body early in the morning on October the 4th, so I didn't have time to talk about it. And I'll get back to it later on the printed sheets that went with that tape. I had quotations of Marguerite Oswald testifying before the Warren Commission that her son was encased in a concrete vault. Also, George C. Thompson, an engineer, wrote in 1965 about that 2,700-pound vault, 1.5 tons reinforced concrete, buried in a very heavy, like a transformer or a gas main underground, impossible to get to. And then Life magazine, December the 6th, 1963, has an article about the 2,700-pound vault that Oswald's body was in, and the funeral director, Paul J. Grudy, said you couldn't break it with a sledgehammer. Now, when this body came up, I've talked with Marina Oswald, and she's asked me not to express some opinions that she has on the air, so what I'm telling you is only my opinion and what I am reading. I don't believe that, I don't know whether that was Oswald's body in there or not, but I personally know that there's no way that was the coffin, that they had gotten in there some way before, whether they simulated the mastoid operation or something else on the body. I don't know what happened, but I know that there was no way that this coffin, when they raised it up, they only took several hours. There was no sledgehammer. The coffin had been cracked. Water had leaked in it. The skeleton, you could see through it, literally a peak breaking open. It wasn't in the condition it was buried in, and it isn't the last word on whether that body had been opened or tampered. There were orders to cremate it. There was a body in there, but there's a lot of trickery with the body. And in the Dallas Morning News, this is October the 5th, the same Paul J. Grody that gave quotations about the burial a long time ago said that he's the undertaker. He's the one who hermetically sealed the casket in 1963 in a 2,700-pound steel-reinforced concrete vault. He said he would not comment after what he saw remained in the grave, but he says, I will have something to say, not right now. So that is not the last word, because he absolutely was there before, and he's not saying what he has to say. But I do have a picture of the casket of Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963 in a book, The Casket of Oswald as It Disappears into a Vault that is vandal-proof and will, according to experts, last 1,000 years. Now, they had to replace the casket because this one had completely torn apart and was cracked, etc. So that isn't the same piece of machinery. What he'll say later, I don't know, but it's not the same piece of machinery. But as I say, in time we'll find out. And one other item before I get on to the Sadat murder, because I want this to be part two of the Sadat murder. Oh, I have several other things I have to rush in to get before we continue on with that assassination. That is, I mentioned last week the selling of the Santa Fe International, that company. in Los Angeles to Kuwait, that Gerald Ford is a member of the board. Now, they are investigating this. The San Francisco Examiner had an article in the Wall Street Journal. The House of Representatives, and I might have mentioned it before, is probing into the bid for the oil drilling because the stock market closed at $22 a share on Monday, the 5th of October, the day before Sadat was murdered. And then the day that he was killed, the Tuesday that he was killed, the stock jumped up to a large, it jumped to $51 a share instead of $22, so that the Kuwait Petroleum made a huge profit, and they're going to investigate in Congress. Now, the identical thing happened at the time John Kennedy was assassinated. It was described in a book, Were We Controlled, by Lincoln Lawrence, how certain people had to have advanced knowledge that John Kennedy was going to be murdered, and it was specifically the Bunge Corporation with their headquarters in Argentina, New Orleans, and New Jersey, the exact central places of the planning of the Kennedy assassination. And the commodities market was sold high. The market dropped, and $500 million was made that day. And the theme of the book was that this corporation had to know in advance because some people made a lot of money. Now, in the case of the Kuwait selling of this buying the Santa Fe International, Gerald Ford is on the board and was pushing in advance. He was one of the people, according to the San Francisco Examiner, who was working with Security Exchange Commission Chairman Broderick Hills, who was unanimously in favor of it. And of course, that day after Sadat was killed, we began sending troops and arms and paraphernalia to the Middle East. So, therefore, the business involving the oil company would increase, and Gerald Ford is on the board of directors. I'll do more on that oil question later, but if you see articles, save it. And finally, before I get into the Sadat murder again for another time here, but not separate, this isn't separate from the story, is a murder that took place that is affecting us today. It took place in Greece of a CIA agent quite a while ago, a few years ago, by the name of Richard Welch. And right now, the CIA is trying to pass a law that we can't name. In fact, the Senate and the House agreed that we can't identify agents who were formerly or currently with the Central Intelligence Agency. And the excuse for that law is Philip Agee and Lewis Wolf and the counter-spy mentioning this particular murder a while back and blaming this publication for the murder of Richard Welch. Now, Philip Agee has done a lot to expose some of the murderers and criminals behind the CIA because he said they had conducted so many military coups in overthrown countries that he left them and began to expose them. The Senate and the House have decided that they will prosecute because people, if they name agents from the past or present. And according to the New York Times, this October the 6th, that was the day that Sadat was murdered, they said under the version of the bill passed in the House of Representatives, if a reporter investigating the reported collaborations of two former agents, Edwin P. Turpel and Frank Turpel and Edwin P. Wilson, with the government of Libya, if we were to learn that they were still working for the CIA, it would be a crime to report it. It would also be a crime to name current or recently employed agents or informers who might be involved. Now, I have been talking about Wilson and Turpel and Coricola for several years now, and they specifically said if we mention their names, that will become a crime. And that is how important those particular names are. And they based that upon Philip Agee's mentioning Richard Welch in a particular publication. Now, the House of Representatives passed this bill, and they said the legislation that was adopted was first suggested more than 5 years ago after CIA station chief in Athens, Richard Welch, was assassinated by gunmen who have never been caught. They never identified this magazine as specifically being linked to the death, but because Richard Welch was assassinated and this magazine run by Philip Agee had identified him as an agent, it became necessary in 1981 to pass this law that we cannot mention them if they are former CIA agents. Now, in going back to a story this week which broke with regard to Mr. Wilson and Turple. And I ask you, who is afraid of George Corcola, Edwin Wilson, and Frank Turple, and Thomas Kleins? Going back to those names, I pulled out of my file an article from the Washington Post by Maxine Cheshire, which I've mentioned on this broadcast before, on the mysterious connection of John Ellsworth. He had a lot to do with the Egypt-Israeli peace treaty. He worked with the PLO. He worked with Arafat. He was at the peace signing treaty at the White House. John Ellsworth worked for the Secret Service, the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, Organized Crime Strike Force, and so forth. He worked with the CIA and the weapons merchants in London. He worked with Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple, and so forth. And Mr. Ellsworth also, in this article, mentioned that he tipped the CIA off that their station chief, Richard Welch, was going to be assassinated in Athens 6 months before it happened, which means that Mr. Ellsworth, who works for the Drug Enforcement, the CIA, the FBI, had to be knowing, and he knew that those people he worked with, such as Frank Turple, Edwin Wilson, and so forth, were going to assassinate the station chief in Athens, the CIA station chief, the one who the CIA is using the excuse now to fine us or put us in jail because of that incident. Well, this past week, as I was going through articles, new articles on the murder of Sadat, I came across an article, a very important story from the Manchester Guardian about Frank Turple being stationed in Cyprus and in Greece and working for the CIA at the time that Richard Welch was shot. Now, the first idea that the CIA knew and was setting him up as excuse to get repressive laws on us, as I say, came December the 2nd, 1979, in the Washington Post, the Maxine Cheshire article. The next article about Richard Welch and the CIA station chief being murdered came in the San Francisco Chronicle and Manchester Guardian, where he was, in fact, murdered. And the article was from men from Counterspy who said that at the time his job was to make a war in Lebanon and Istanbul and so forth, that he was part of a secret criminal police force that was working in Cyprus, Beirut, and Tel Aviv, and that he had a staff of 170, and that Richard Welch was working in Greece at the time that he was instigating wars in Lebanon for the CIA, and he was in Cyprus at the time that Frank Turple for the CIA was stationed in Cyprus. The Washington Post this week, October the 10th, says that Frank Turple from 1975 to 1976 was a CIA agent in active duty stationed on the Greek island near Cyprus, and he set up a CIA dummy front airline called ADCO Airlines and used the name of Richard Ashcroft, president of Stanford Technology in Sunnyvale, California. Again, these assassination teams, the roots of them come back to the crazies and the funding in California. The Stanford Technology story is a complicated, large story that I'll be going with you on the air. It involves the Hewlett-Packard organization when Packard was the Secretary of Defense in Washington, D.C. But Frank Turple was working with a dummy front from Palo Alto and Sunnyvale, California, when he was stationed in Greece at the time the CIA was killing Welch to blame Philip Agee and get these repressive laws that we're facing in 1981. Now, another article in the New York Times, October the 11th, this week, by Jeff Gerth and Philip Talman, says that Stanford Technology was run and started by an Iranian CIA agent named Albert Hakim. He controlled Stanford Technology. Now, the employees are David Short, worked for Hewlett-Packard, and Hakim was in Iran at the time that Richard Helms left the United States in disgrace after Watergate and was working with the CIA and the Shah of Iran. Richard Helms worked with Hakim, who set up Stanford Technology, who funded Turple, who had his phony airline in Athens at the time that CIA agent Welch was going to be sacrificed so they could get laws that Ronald Reagan is putting today to us to lock up the papers so we can't prove that they killed him in order to not only silence Philip Agee, but silence him, but to get all of us researchers. I'll do a little more about that and some more terrible scandals this week. We'll take a one-minute break and go back to this connection because it didn't happen a long time ago. The laws were passed this week by the Senate and the House that they want to strangle us now that the pieces of the criminal puzzle are really coming together.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.